This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moskowain, in for Terry Gross. Let's face it, everyone is curious about the results of sex surveys. They shed a little light on the private behavior everyone engages in, but few admit in public. Sex surveys have been the staple of so-called men's and women's magazines and have made Kinsey and Masters and Johnson household names. My guest, Julia Erickson, is the co-author of a new book, Kiss and Tell, which reviews 100 years of sex surveys from the late 19th century to today. She found that the questions, even more than the answers, have had a lasting influence on what sexual behavior is considered appropriate and what is seen as deviant. Erickson is a professor of sociology at Temple University. A caution to parents before we start our conversation. Some of this material may not be suitable for younger listeners. I asked Julia Erickson about the early surveys and the language that the Victorian researchers used in their work.
Well, the first published survey, which was undertaken in 1898, and was a survey of young men. There was a lot of concern at the time that young men would develop an interest in, a precocious interest in sexuality, and if they did it too early, they wouldn't really develop into the kind of fine, upstanding, middle-class young men that the nation needed. This was only a survey of the middle class. And there were three questions that were asked on that survey, and one was, what is your severest temptation? And
the second that's a direct quote, right?
Yes. The second one was, did you yield? And the third one was, how often?
Huh.
And, of course, today, I don't know that people would say sex necessarily. If you said, what is your severest temptation? They might say chocolate or ice cream or something to do with food or, you know, something else. Or alcohol, perhaps, or smoking. But at the time, almost all of these young men knew the question meant sex. And they either, most of them said masturbation. And a significant minority of them said prostitution.
That they saw that
as the severest temptation. Yes.
So even though the word sex was never used, yes. It was the language of the time. Middle class men knew,
understood
what
it meant. Yes.
What do you think, though, in asking the questions the way they did, the researchers were trying to do and say? And your book really is about how the questions really mm-hmm. have an influence and shape our mm-hmm. view of sexuality mm-hmm. and men and women and men and men mm-hmm. and women and women. What were the cautionary words or the cautionary point of view that was coming out of those questions?
That young men had a precocious interest in sexuality, even very good young men. And in fact, in that particular survey, a group of the young men were training for the ministry, and they too were tempted by masturbation, and most of them had yielded. And the author, the survey was actually done by a worker for the YMCA, and they were quite horrified, but they clearly expected to find those results. And there were a whole series of surveys done over the next 15 or 20 years showing that the nation really was in trouble because boys were learning from other boys too early about sex, developing an interest in sex too early, not developing healthy same-sex play interests. And this was going to be bad for the nation's future.
So it was about trying to control then these
yes,
sexual urges.
Yes, yes. And in fact, some of the researchers even said before they undertook the research that they knew what they expected to find. And what they were trying to promote was sex education in the schools, and a sex education of the sort that would tell you what not to do, you know, what we might, didn't use the word then, but what we might call abstinence education. Right. They thought if young men learned about sex from the proper source, then they wouldn't misbehave. They would know that this was too precious an activity. But if they were learning about it on the street, they were learning of these bad activities.
And the proper source was what? School?
Religious leaders? Family, ideally, but families weren't educated to do it. If you could raise a generation, that was the theory behind sex education, if you could raise a generation of Americans in the schools to know how to talk about sex and its dangers in a serious way, then that generation would be able to raise their children properly. We're still waiting for that to happen, I might say, but...
And you talk about, I guess, the sublimation of yes. these sexual energies into sports, what?
Into play, into other activities, into sports. So this was a very significant part of the reason for the founding of the YMCA was to give boys healthy activities and take their minds away from precocious activities. But particularly, there was a lot of concern about cities. The idea was that on farms, boys had worked and they'd been stayed as children for much longer period of time. They hadn't had these interests. But the cities were full of vice and sin, and you could get away from your parents. Your parents didn't know what you were doing. And that's really the rationale for founding the YMCA.
Well, getting us into the 1920s, and you see a kind of a shift there, that the emphasis being on sex as a pleasurable relationship between husbands and wives, mm-hmm. and the idea that it wasn't just a woman's duty, I guess, to mm-hmm. perform sex with her husband, but there actually could be some kind of fulfilling relationship mm-hmm. between a husband and wife in a family. How did some of those surveys reflect some of those changes?
By the 1920s in the United States, there was a tremendous concern about rising divorce. This is the most divorcing society probably in the world, and divorces started occurring here much earlier than elsewhere. And many social critics in the 1920s were very concerned about divorce. And so one of the things that they were, particularly among the middle class again, I mean, it's really important to emphasize that until probably the 1970s, there's very little concern about anybody other than the middle class.
Isn't that interesting?
In these surveys. And but this concern about divorce was that there was a lot of, you know, a lot of these people are eugenicists, so they believe that the middle class have better genes and they're going to produce better children. There's a lot of concern that women aren't marrying because they're going to college and maybe even becoming lesbians if they go to single-sex colleges. And so all of these concerns about divorce, about women going away to school, not needing men, becoming financially independent, led to this, I think, pitch, more or less, to educated women that their true destiny lay in marriage and that a satisfying sex life would be one very important part of this happy marriage. There's a kind of discovery of this female sex drive in this during this period and a focusing it towards what's seen as a kind of safe outlet within marriage. Men and women are going to stay together. The divorce is going to decline because they're going to have good sex in marriage. So you get a whole series of surveys to see what the state of marital sex is like.
But I wonder for women trying to answer these surveys, mm-hmm. Going from this sort of Victorian mm-hmm. time to the early 20s, mm-hmm. People don't change overnight, mm-hmm. whether they felt that they were kind of up to the task, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of controversy about the state of sex in the Victorian marriage, and that's just a little bit of another topic. So I'm not sure that I want to make the assumption that Victorian marriage was always totally sexually repressive, although it probably was more, there was a little more repression than there is today. But I think during this period, these women were very concerned to make them. These were married women, and they were engaged. Some of them, at times, they interviewed engaged couples. They were very concerned to make their marriages work. They were mostly college students. By this time, there were dozens of courses on marriage and the family in American universities. It's the single biggest growth course in sociology departments in the country. And I think perhaps the reason that sociology grew so rapidly in America has to do with these courses. And so it sort of solved the problem of what to do about girls going to college was to teach them how to have better marriages. And so many of these surveys who were being done of these college students or college graduates who'd taken these kinds of courses and who knew that they were supposed to be good at sex, but who also worried that they were too sexually repressed and that this had learned from the research that this was going to be a difficult task and they weren't necessarily going to find it very easy. So I actually think more than a kind of Victorian carryover, what the surveys themselves are telling these women about, your marriage will depend on a good sex life, but a good sex life is going to be hard for you.
A very mixed message.
Yes.
I wonder, too, if there was concern in the 1920s about the negative impact of divorce and the idea of focusing on family and sex being part of a relationship between a husband and wife. Were the researchers successful? Were they able to reduce the divorce rate?
No,
okay.
Divorces continued
very
to go
very humbling
up
to be a researcher.
Throughout
right?
this whole period, yes. But they continued to teach it for a very, very long time. They continued to teach these courses on marriage and to do their research and to try to figure out, you know, what constituted a good marital relationship and what constituted a good sexual relationship. And there was a little debate about whether the poor state of women's sexual response within marriage was due to the repression of girls and the poor upbringing of girls and the way girls were being taught to be sex repressed, or was it because the husbands were incompetent lovers? Because nobody ever had any doubt that men were in charge of the sexual relationship and that they initiated and women responded. The writers were quite explicit about that, actually.
And sort of promoting this idea that a woman's sexuality is just much more submissive or more passive,
yes,
less
yes.
imaginative.
Yes, and that it's women are aroused by pursuit.
More about a century of sex surveys after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is sociologist Julia Erickson, author of the book Kiss and Tell, about sex surveys done over the last 100 years. Well, Kinsey's a name I think that most people know. How would you say that he revolutionized sex surveys, if he did at all?
Yes, I think he did. And I think probably the most important thing about Kinsey was that after Kinsey, sex surveys became something that the media got interested in and wrote about. And before Kinsey, the only writings in the media about sex, so usually were in the 1930s, there were some articles about dangers to children of pedophiles. There was a lot of concern about pedophilia, and there were a lot of that, very much in the same way we've had panics recently about pedophilia in the 1930s, but there'd been very little else written about sex. And Kinsey published these two volumes that got enormous press. And it may interest you to know, for example, that when Kinsey wrote his first volume, but it was published in 1948, the volume on American men, the New York Times refused to accept advertising for the book because it didn't think it was respectable in the Times. And that just shows, you know, a tremendous difference in the way the media would respond today.
And he was a biologist,
he
right?
Was a biologist,
as opposed to a social scientist. And I don't know whether that gave him sort of more cachet or not.
It certainly helped him get funding. He got funding from there was a national committee that had a lot of Rockefeller money. Most of his money came from Rockefeller Foundation. And it helped him get funding because he was seen as more respectable. And he was not interested in kind of why people did what they did and what their emotional feelings were or how they identified themselves. He said he saw himself as a collector of what people do. He was only interested in what he saw as the facts about what people do and not the emotions.
Well, it sounds like a biologist's approach to people's sexual behavior.
That's right.
What were, though, his biases as you look at his research and perhaps even the language of his research? Where did he sort of show up in his own work?
Well, he has two kinds of biases. One is he'd actually been an entomologist and he'd collected insects before. He collected a kind of gall wasp, and he still at the Kinsey Institute, there's this huge collection of hundreds of thousands of gall wasps that Kinsey collected from country after country. And as a collector of insects, he'd been interested in getting samples of every kind of variety. So he was much more interested in checking the varieties of sexual experience than he was in understanding how frequently these occurred in the population. And because of that, he spent a lot of time collecting data on people whose sexual behavior was not the typical, average sexual behavior.
Such as?
Well, he has higher rates of men who have sex with other men, for example. He probably has higher rates of he interviewed a lot of prostitutes, probably more than, because by the time that he was interviewing, actually, prostitution was really declining in number. Prostitutes were declining in number in the United States. He was interested in people who had contact with animals. He wanted to taste the variety of sexual experiences. Uh-huh. So that was one bias. The other bias that I think is kind of a result of both of his being a scientist and of his own desire to liberate sexuality, which he didn't recognize at all.
But you can kind of read that into his research.
I don't think there's any doubt. And I interviewed both his co-researchers, and they really did understand quite explicitly that Kinsey had felt that sex needed to be liberated. And then every now and then in the book he gives little diatribes anyway that make it very clear that, you know, it's not that coded. But he felt that he actually believed that we probably all, that any kind of sexual outlet was just equally valuable to any other kind of sexual outlet, and that he didn't believe some people were this way and some people that way. He really believed we probably would all do everything if we were given the opportunity, and that we were in this sex repressive society, and that people suffered incredibly terribly for the fact that they had so many sexual desires repressed, and that this caused all kinds of problems, particularly problems for marriage. I will say that he was very pro-marriage and the family, despite this liberationist
viewpoint. Well, it's an interesting tension,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yes. Well, not really. I think he just thought that he saw marriage as something that was necessary for the raising of children and the good of society, but he probably, well, I think it's pretty clear that he thought that if society wasn't so sexually repressed, that people wouldn't necessarily tie sexual fidelity in as part of marriage.
Well, he's still quoted today, and I wonder how you think his research stands up. Of course, that's 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago. People are different. There's been a lot of research since that time.
I don't think that you can place any reliability on his results because his sample was very poor for the reasons that I've already explained. And he wouldn't do probability sampling. And in fact, when the most prominent statisticians of the day wanted to do probability sampling, he wouldn't do it. So in that sense, I don't think he's data reliable. But he did have some very interesting ways of interviewing that I think are still quite provocative and quite informative.
In what way? I mean, how would he get people? I'd assume you're talking about getting people to talk about themselves and talk about their behavior.
Well, he asked questions in a way that researchers don't normally ask. He was very concerned to give people permission to talk about things that they might not confess to. And so, for example, instead of saying, have you ever masturbated, he said, when did you first start masturbating? And he left it up to the respondent to deny that they'd masturbated. And if the respondent said, I never masturbated, later on he might say, well, when did you first start? Well, I know that, but when did you first start?
I wonder, too, with Masters and Johnson, I mean, I think that's another name that the people associate with sex surveys. What did they bring to the discussion? And it seemed the way you wrote that they were more sort of female-centric, that they were more inclusive of female sexuality.
Yeah, technically, they didn't quite do a survey because what they actually did was watch people have sex, which is a little bit different. But what they did and what they had tremendous impact on surveys because what they did was discover the clitoral orgasm. Now, Kinsey had actually reported that women's orgasms are in their clitoris, but it was ignored and it wasn't picked up by the press and it just disappeared. You know, it wasn't one of those factoids, as you call it. But when Masters and Johnson wrote, the women's movement was getting going. That was picked up by the women's movement as a sort of militant female statement. And Kinsey, and so from then on, you get a lot of interest in things like multiple orgasm, are women capable of having multiple orgasms?
G-spots.
You get into, and you also get interest in female masturbation, which hasn't really been quite such an interesting topic, at least since Catherine Davis in 1918.
but masturbation does appear through 100 years of surveys. I mean, a lot of concern about the effects of masturbation. I mean, that was clear reading through your book. Well, I wonder, as we look at like the Playboy magazines, the Cosmopolitan, which probably is the female version of Playboy, what they brought to the whole sort of discussion about sex, and even the kinds of surveys that they might have run, you know, there's that sort of play, and even how the sort of Playboy philosophy was supposedly about, you know, female sex, and I would assume that the Cosmo philosophy was something about the, you know, what male sexuality was about. What do you see?
Well, I think those commercial surveys did three things. First of all, they set in the public mind that that's what a survey was, but they also really do give the public a place to go to find if what they're doing is normal. And they actually turn out to be quite reader-specific. And so, for example, if you take Cosmo and Ladies' Home Journal, they both did sex surveys. And they're geared to a very different audience. And so Ladies' Home Journal will say things like, X percent of the women in our survey had affairs outside of marriage. But that was much lower than Redbook found. Because they're doing their readers,
course,
you know. So they're
course.
Positioning Ladies' Home Journal. Cosmo, on the other hand, which is actually one of my favorite questions, in their question about how often you had sex, they code the answers. And you see, I think by giving the readers boxes to fill in, where those boxes are located is extremely important in telling you what normal is. And so Cosmo has several times a day as its first possible response, once a day is the second possible response, several times a week, and then once a week or less. So I assume if you're not sexually active at the moment, you have to check once a week or less because that's the only place to go. But it tells you that, you know, that the middle boxes are what people think they ought to check. Now, Ladies' Home Journal, on the other hand, you know, starts with several times a week and then several times a month, and it has a different set of boxes. And so it's all they're also telling their readers in a way what's appropriate, you know, what people do just by the kinds of boxes they set up to check as answers. So I actually think the way in which they are telling readers what's normal for us is very interesting. And then, you know, a magazine like Cosmo lauds the fact that the Cosmo girl is more sexually active than any other, you know, the readers of any other magazines.
Sociologist Julia Erickson is the co-author of Kiss and Tell. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.